Hi guys, welcome back to the Endurance Podcast. Today we're going to be talking about hydration. So, ready to go, Tim?
Ready, as always. So, let's just start. Ready as always.
So, we've had quite a few questions from your social media to cover later on. But first of all, we're going to do a bit of an overview about why hydration is important, why we need to be bothered about hydration during our training, during our racing.
Yeah, so hydration is one of those topics that comes like sometimes the people see it differently as nutrition, but I think like it comes together. So nutrition and hydration are probably equally important when it comes to performance and endurance or whatever related to sport. The reason being that like around probably even more than for most people than 60% of our bodies consists of water. And we all know that kind of any deviations from homeostasis, be it the temperature, be it the water content, does not really work well on the humans. So once we lose water or we get too much water, this can cause like perturbation to homeostasis and this can cause problems. So we want to kind of maintain the water intake the same as the water intake should be the same as the water output, basically. So that at the end of the day, the hydration is maintained. And we also kind of want to maintain it during exercise. And we'll come to this later on today, I guess.
Yeah, so I guess over the course of the day, it's not normally such a big issue. Your thirst mechanism is pretty good about telling you how much you need to drink, and also you're obviously getting fluids from your food as well. I guess exercise is a problem because you get big changes in your hydration status in quite a short period of time. So it's hard for your body to keep up with that homeostasis and hard for your thirst mechanisms to enable you to catch up.
Yeah, exactly. So during exercise, why we basically lose water is because we need to cool down. And humans, as like not like probably the only mammals that actually produce sweat in like big quantities. So once we sweat, there are water droplets that come out of the skin. They appear on the surface of the skin, and they either drop down to the floor, or they get evaporated or turned into the gas. And once the droplets are turned to gas, for this process, energy is required. And basically, this energy is basically heat dissipation. So we lose heat by converting the water droplets into the gas. And the water that drips down to the floor is basically the sweat that's been lost for nothing. So we didn't really lose any heat in that regard. So during exercise, the higher the heat stress, so the hotter we feel, basically the more sweat we produce. And production of sweat like differs from athlete to athlete, and probably comes down to like multiple different factors. And one of the most important ones, are like, the environmental conditions. So whether it's actually hot outdoors, or it's cold outdoors, this is the first one. The second one is humidity. So the more humid the air it is, the more, sweat will probably produce. Although this is not as important as the temperature itself. And the third really, really important factor is probably, or it is actually, the heat production, so actually the workload. So if we are cycling at, let's say, 300 watts, the heat production is much higher than when we are like cycling at 100 watts. So the more intense the exercise, in the absolute terms, the more heat we will produce, and thus the more heat we have to dissipate, and therefore we sweat more. So elite athletes are known to produce very, very large quantities of sweat during exercise, and these values can easily reach like more than 2 liters per hour. And that's kind of, if we consider and think about prolonged endurance exercise, like 3, 4, 5 hours, that's like a heck of a lot of sweat that we produce and lose during exercise. On the other end of the spectrum, there might be like cold days, and less trained athletes. Like, for instance, imagine like a marathon on an autumn morning, like in anywhere in Europe, it's probably like chilly, like 10 degrees, 11 degrees Celsius. And an untrained athlete would probably be only like sweating like 400 or 500 milliliters per hour because, well, the conditions are not super hot and also the workload is not as high. So we have to adjust the water intake according to basically the sweat rate.
So that's why you see very different fluid needs from, say, that sort of amateur athlete easily enough water and fluids on board, whereas Tour de France cyclists on a hot July day, they're just constantly drinking. You see people coming back from the team car with 15 bottles to hand out to their teammates, and it's still not enough. Interesting from that, I think in the pool of sweat you see under the turbo when you're doing a indoor session, even in the winter, that's wasted fluid really, isn't it? Because it's not helping you to cool down, or maybe you're in the gym and it's hot and humid. It's a bit harder for that sweat to evaporate in those big pools of sweat on the ground. Wasted water really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So, and this is when like ventilation becomes super important, because what happens is that the water that's not like flowing, I mean, the air that it's not being moved around the body basically gets saturated with water. So you can't, like the air can't take any more of the water. And that's why basically the sweat has to drop down because it has nowhere to go. And that's why we have a lot of water beneath our bikes in the winter, unless we have like very good ventilation. And that's why like fans are really important to have on winter training.
So when you see the steam coming up off yourself, it's probably not a good sign that you're efficiently cooling your body in that session.
Yeah, exactly.
So how much dehydration can we get away with? And you said it's pretty much impossible to replace those 2 liters per hour sweat rates that you might be kicking out on a really hot day if you're a fit athlete. How much can we get away with?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and a question that like scientists and sports nutritionists have been asking for ages. And there are like numerous debates in the scientific literature. Some say, well, dehydration is not as problematic if you're like drinking according to thirst, so the sensation of thirst, just listening to your body and drinking based on your what the body dictates you. On the other hand, there is like quite a few scientists out there saying that, well, in like for high performance athletes, that perhaps is not sufficient, because we become thirsty once we already lose quite large amounts of fluids. So there are like both camps, one camp like recommending just drinking to thirst, the other one prescribed drinking which should match the sweat rate. So basically you sweat out, fluid in the same amount. But probably the kind of the middle way is the way to go, or the way I would probably go. And the first thing is to ask yourself, when does actually dehydration really impair performance? And like looking at the evidence, it's pretty clear then. So the dehydration actually impairs performance during really high intensity efforts. And this is when like VO2 max or maximal oxygen uptake becomes a limiting factor. And we know that maximal oxygen uptake is basically limited by supply of the blood or the red blood cells or the oxygen to the muscles. So what happens during high intensity exercise, especially in the hot conditions, is that blood goes to the muscles and blood goes to the skin. Blood to the skin goes there so that we can basically cool down, produce sweat. On the other hand, blood goes to the muscle to get there the required oxygen. And with dehydration, obviously, we reduce this amount of plasma volume, so the watery part of the blood. And what happens is either both of them or one of those big organs like skin or the muscle gets less blood. And as a result of that, obviously, we either impair the delivery of oxygen, so the performance goes down, or we impair the effects of cooling, so the body temperature starts to increase. And we also know that this can affect performance in a negative way. And that's why we can conclude, during really high intensity efforts, it's a fact that dehydration to probably any degree impairs performance. So really small amounts of dehydration will already kind of show an impairment in performance. And it's just then down to sensitivity of our test to basically see this or not. So what do I mean when I say high intensity exercise? I think this is anything above the critical power, because the critical power is kind of the threshold above which you will inevitably reach the VO2 max. So basically that's kind of the exercise that you can like sustain for like 30, 40 minutes all out. Anything probably shorter than this will probably be negatively affected by dehydration. However, when we're talking about longer duration exercise, when we're talking about like 1 hour, 2 hours, 4 hours, the evidence actually points more towards some degree of dehydration is actually okay. Like 3%, 4% reduction in body mass from the start to the end of exercise is actually just fine. Because we also have to know that with reduction of body mass, for instance, if you're like talking about runners or even cyclists, certain degree of dehydration obviously will impair the cooling, because well, you're not exercising at maximal oxygen uptake, so there is probably plenty of still enough blood to actually supply muscles with oxygen. But for instance, the core body temperature might be a bit higher, but at the same time, your body mass is lower. And as a result of that, you basically gain something and lose something. And at the end of the day, there is no impairment of performance. And if we actually look at the evidence, like how much, body mass the best athletes actually lose during ultra marathons and races like that, we actually see, that they can get away or win races actually by losing like 5-6% of body mass, from start to finish. And they are winning the races. So we can't really say, well, there is like a magical number of 2% that high degradation of that will negatively affect performance. It's not like that. It's like, it really does comes down to the context. Like we probably want to kind of minimize hydration in a way, but sometimes it's impossible. Like, to getting 2 liters of water per hour into the body, that's probably mission impossible. So we have to be like sensible and to think like what's achievable and what's not.
And that's when for those longer efforts, other kind of strategies to kind of, okay, you're going to be dehydrated, but can we minimize that effect on your core temperature rising with cooling strategies, with ice or spraying water over yourself, etc., to sort of counteract some of those negative effects, become more important on a hot day.
Yeah, exactly. So for instance, like just getting like water on the skin, basically that's artificial sweat. So we are helping the body to sweat, and the body doesn't need to produce more sweat. It's just not like just the water being cold is actually the sweat, so it's going to evaporate. Also, the other thing from like pouring the water over the body is because we also lose electrolytes in the sweat, and those electrolytes start accumulating on the surface of the skin. And the more electrolytes there are, the more difficult it is for the water to get converted to gas. So by rinsing down the skin, we actually reduce the amount of electrolytes in the skin or the salt. And then the sweat should evaporate quickly and more efficiently. That's another thing that perhaps not many people are aware of, but it's kind of important in my view. And the other thing we can also do is like pre-hydration strategies, like increase the amount of water we have before the start of the race. Even though this means like a kilo or a couple of kilos more water, or like, more body mass at the start of the race. But for the remainder of the race and towards the end, when it really counts, the performance, we still have, we perhaps have more water available, so we can achieve higher exercise intensities because we might be limited by like the amount of heat we can dissipate.
So in terms of prehydration, I mean, your body's pretty good at dealing with excess water with urine. So to kind of help with that prehydration, you're needing to take on extra electrolytes or carbs alongside that to encourage the storage, right?
Yeah, exactly. So probably like when we talk about glycogen loading increases body mass, not because you just basically load carbohydrates, but primarily because like every gram of glycogen binds like 3 to 4 grams of water. So basically we store more water as a result of glycogen loading. And the second thing we can also do, and we discussed this the previous time when you talk about sodium bicarbonate. So large amounts of like sodium or salt electrolytes before the start of the race in the morning or the previous day can actually increase the amount of water in the body, like cause water retention. This can be in certain scenarios unwanted, like I don't know, uphill time trial, we don't want that. But for instance, we want that for like 4 hours of exercise in the like in the middle of the day in 30 degrees heat or 35 degrees heat. That's when this can be really a good strategy to do many electrolytes before the start, like in the hours before. And you might feel like very full and very heavy. And when you try to like wear your the cycling jersey, it might be like a bit tight fit, but it's going to work well.
So that's something you could do literally in the hour or two before the start of your race if it's in hot conditions, not something you need to do in the days before necessarily. A quick turnaround. Cool. And you mentioned about slower athletes not sweating so much before. There's a risk of overhydration or insufficient electrolytes that goes alongside with that, isn't it? If people think, oh, well, I'm doing a marathon, I need to drink 2 litres an hour, but they're actually only sweating half a litre an hour. That can be quite dangerous, can't it?
Yeah. So the problem is that we can't really say, when you talk, for instance, about carbohydrates, we give like, you need to say like, we say like 45 grams per hour or like one energy unit per hour or 2 energy units per hour of carbohydrates. That's kind of the optimal amount. But when it comes to hydration, I'm very hesitant to actually give out recommendations on exact how much people should drink. Because there were like scenarios in the past, that people actually died from the so-called water intoxication or exercise associated hyponatremia. And this is kind of basically over hydration. So what actually happens is that if you ingest really large amounts of especially water during exercise, basically you start to dilute the blood. So the concentration of electrolytes in the blood, especially sodium, starts to drop. And as a result of that, the water starts going to the cells. So muscle cells, and the most problematic are brain cells. And I mentioned earlier that you might be like, when you're doing overhydration, like prehydration, you might be feeling a bit more full. And this is just basically water retention. But if this happens, before exercise, nothing is going to happen because basically the body will not be under such stress, and you will just produce urine, go to the toilet, and get rid of the excess water. Whereas what happens during exercise is that some people might just respond to exercise in a way they would just accumulate the water, so there would be no like urine output. So if you were to drink too much, the body couldn't get rid of the water and would just retain in the body. And then we have the skull, which is kind of the bone. It can't get bigger. And the problem is when the cells start to get more water in, and there's basically no space where they can get bigger, and then the brain cells start to basically pop and die. And this is kind of something that has happened in the past. It's called exercise-associated hyponatremia. There are many cases, too many cases, that people died because of this. And this probably happened because, and this especially like happens on marathons, like 42K long distances, in autumn, in early mornings, when it's like 8 degrees Celsius, for instance. And then we have slower runners that are not producing a lot of heat. And then they run, and because they listen to recommendations, they stop on every aid station, drink a cup of electrolyte containing drink or like carbohydrate containing drink, and go on, and then just repeat. And after 4 hours or 3 hours or whatever, they are like 3 kilos heavier, because basically they pretty much didn't sweat, but they gained water, and that water didn't go get out of the body because the body was under stress and didn't produce any urine. And this can be very dangerous. So we want to avoid it. So the first rule is never drink more than you actually lose. And how to do that? I don't know. Like you can do it like pre and post weighing in certain conditions and figure out how much sweat you're losing, or just relying on thirst. And I think in like relatively cold conditions and like temperate conditions, I think relying on thirst is just enough. It's the hot weather when you know you're going to max out the sweat rates, then you can actually do like drink as much as basically can.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got a few questions from our listeners. We kind of condensed a few of them together in some cases as well. But the first one, we've had quite a few people ask about the role of sodium and electrolytes in hydration. And as you mentioned, how to ensure you're well hydrated before a race, and whether you can actually overdo it on the electrolytes as well. We've heard you can overdo it underwater during a race potentially, but can you overdo it on the electrolytes, and what would happen if you did?
Yeah, so this comes down to like back to the question when I just talked about exercise associated hyponatremia. And many people say, well, that's why we are drinking isotonic drinks. And isotonic drinks, people believe that the concentration of electrolytes is basically the same as in the blood plasma, or in the blood, let's say. Let's simplify it. But the problem is that osmotically active particles are basically electrolytes and also the glucose. So isotonic drink means that there is basically the same amount or concentration of osmotically active particles in the drink as it is in the human blood or plasma. The problem is that if we look at the composition of the blood or the plasma and compare it to the sports drink, we will see that in a sports drink, there is always way more electrolytes than it is in the plasma. Because like in the whole blood, human blood or plasma, there is like 3.5 grams of glucose floating around, whereas in half a liter of a sports drink, we have like 45 grams of carbohydrates. And if you want like an isotonic drink, what we have to do is then reduce the amount of electrolytes in the drink. So just speaking about the electrolytes, pretty much all the drinks are hypotonic. So basically, if you drink those drinks and everything gets absorbed into the bloodstream, you're basically diluting the blood of electrolytes. So the concentration of electrolytes starts to drop. So you can get exercise-associated hyponatremia, which is the reduction in the amount of sodium in the blood, just by drinking pretty much any drink you get out on the market. So if you were to actually do a drink that would be containing the same amount of electrolytes as like the same concentration of electrolytes in the human plasma, you would basically be drinking seawater pretty much. So very unpleasant drink, and something you don't really want to drink at all. So if you would like add carbohydrates to this seawater and drink that, so you would get basically the same amount of electrolytes as the same concentration of electrolytes as in the human plasma, but it adds on the top of that carbohydrates, what you will then end up is very, very highly concentrated and osmotically like hyper osmotic drink, which would, after ingestion, resulted the osmolality of the solution in the stomach or in the intestines would be much higher than in the human blood. So what that means is that the water would start to flow from the blood into the intestines and not the other way around, which is what we want. And once this occurs, that's gonna cause diarrhea. And that's why too many electrolytes electrolytes in the drinks can cause gastrointestinal discomfort.
Yeah.
So basically, when you think about supplementing electrolytes during exercise, we really have to think about which electrolytes and in which quantities do we actually add into the drink to minimize the stress on the gastrointestinal system. And in a way, it's a bit stupid to be actually looking at the blood. I think it's more important to be looking at the sweat concentrations, because the aim is basically to replace what we are actually losing during exercise.
Yeah.
So for instance, when we were thinking about the endurance electrolyte mix, we didn't think about the plasma at all or the blood. We were thinking about the sweat. So what are we losing during exercise? And we know that sweat is actually hypotonic. So basically, we lose more water than we lose electrolytes. And we can actually pretty easily, or in many instances for many athletes, achieve that the drink can be just fine with the same amount of electrolytes that are losing in the sweat. So pretty much sodium, chloride, some calcium, and very small amounts of magnesium with electrolytes, and we get basically the optimal hydration solution. So to sum up, you want just the electrolytes that you're using during in the sweat, and to a certain degree, because we know that certain amount of dehydration is okay, perhaps you don't even need to like supplement or replace all the electrolytes during exercise, especially when it comes to like prolonged endurance exercise. There is like some suggestions that electrolytes are not as important as what people think, and that we can get away without ingesting any additional electrolytes when the exercise's duration is lower than 4 hours. It's a bit like very strong opinion to say like something like this, because I still think that it makes sense to replace electrolytes during exercise, yeah, even if it's like perhaps evidence hasn't shown clearly that this helps, but it makes sense because like looking at the physiological system, it makes sense to replace them. So I'm like, yeah, why not if they're not causing issues? And I think in most cases, if we do it right, they don't cause issues and are a welcome addition to a carbohydrate drink.
I mean, you're going to have to replace them eventually, aren't you? Because you're,
exactly,
you're losing it. So I guess you may as well replace them within the drink you're taking on board, especially since you're probably not going to be able to drink as much as you're sweating in a lot of cases as well.
Yeah.
So kind of in summary, in terms of sort of prehydration, you need to take on electrolytes at the same time as you're taking on water if you want to prehydrate before,
yes,
you exercise. And then during, it totally makes sense to, yeah, you replace what you're sweating out. So you're trying to maintain that composition of the blood electrolytes rather than going overboard with it and then potentially almost dehydrating yourself by taking water out of the blood into the stomach to dilute it. Another question we had was talk about hydration planning for a stage race or I guess a multi-day sportive would be similar. And from my point of view, it's like obviously Tour de France, you've got team cars all the time, you've got soigneurs by the side of the road handing you bottles. It's quite easy to, well, maybe not easy if you're sweating 2 litres per hour, but it's easier to replace the foods that you're losing from an unsupported rider's point of view. And especially if you're doing a sportive at the kind of pointy ends and you want to be racing for the win, you don't necessarily want to stop all these water stops. So how would you suggest tackling hydration in it, especially a multi-day event like that?
Yeah, so the most important thing to me would be like get to the event heat acclimated. For instance, heat acclimation really increase the amount of water you store even before the exercise. So this will help. You will be losing less electrolytes in the sweat. You will feel the thirst better. And basically you will be like better accustomed to exercise in the conditions. And then it's very difficult to like logistically organize the water, during exercise. And I think like I've done it myself, like on 1 day, races in the summer. Basically I ran out of water and that's basically the worst thing that can happen because as soon as you're thirsty, this basically means that the performance will suffer. And there is no like going, there is no solution to this other than like somehow get the fluids. I think it's like getting enough water is just, yeah, super important. Stopping on aid stations and stuff, that would just help. And obviously here, like pre-hydration strategies can actually help. And when we're talking about multi-day events, I think it's really, really important that we kind of care about the hydration, after the race, because hydration, yeah, obviously we want to replace the fluids lost. And sometimes it can happen that body mass will decrease by like 5 or even 6% in the severe heat, which is like actually okay, but we just need to like kind of replace all the fluids and the carbohydrates. And we have to start doing that as soon as possible after exercise. And there's actually some interesting evidence that like, I think it was milk, to be like the optimal hydration solution after exercise. But for instance, when we also like designed the endurance recovery shake, we also added the electrolytes for the sake of retaining water, because electrolytes are like, we lost them during exercise and they help retain water. And we actually basically want to retain water after exercise. If we were to just replace water, not electrolytes, then, basically the water is not going to be as efficiently stored in the body as with addition of electrolytes. So like rehydrating with just water is not ideal. So this is that. And then by the end of the evening or the day, you probably want to have a clear urine. So there is no like not yellow anymore, but clear. So that you know, yeah, that, well, hydration is pretty good. And then the next morning as well, make sure that you start the race with a clear urine color, which means that you're well hydrated and well prepared for the race. If you have a chance to like measure urine specific gravity or osmolality, you can like buy a handheld meter. This can also help to just double check if the hydration is okay or not. But I'm overcomplicating here. But yeah, checking the urine color, it's clear. Not check it during exercise because it's going to be yellow, whatever you do. And that's normal. It's not that you're like under hydrating yourself, but after exercise urine color is a pretty good indicator of hydration status.
That's a, you know, quick and simple thing that anyone can do to keep track of that. So yeah, rather than complicating things with extra measurements, that's probably a good way to start, isn't it?
Or on another thing would be like changing checking body mass. pre and post. So for instance, if you measure your body mass in the morning and then after the race, so I've lost like 2 kilos, as a rule of thumb, I would recommend then 1.5 times that amount of fluid over the last the first few hours, which means like I lost 2 kilos, so I need to drink 3 liters of water in the like in the course of like 2 to 3 hours, or not water, like let's say rehydration solution. Yeah,
and then doing it in the morning of the next stage, you've got an idea of how successful that was, and if you find it's still a kilo down, then obviously you've got to try that a little bit harder to prehydrate yourself before the next stage.
Exactly.
So following on from that, there's talk about, I forget which race it was now, I think whether it was the Tour or the Giro that he won, but there was talk about Chris Froome intentionally dehydrating himself a little bit over the course of a stage, so that when it came to the final key mountain climb, he was a kilo or two lighter. And obviously watts per kilo equals speed when it comes to going up the climbs. The kind of what you said earlier about the intensity, and obviously on a long 40 minute plus mountain that we're talking about here, then you're not in VO2 max territory necessarily, or at least not for very much of that. So I guess that kind of puts you in there, as long as you're cooling yourself sufficiently otherwise, that's maybe a bit of a performance gain there. What do you feel about that?
It's a really, really, really tough question. And I personally wouldn't risk it going that way, especially because in the summer we know that cooling is really important, and the amount of heat these guys produce is just amazing. Like, imagine like if they're like 25% efficient, so like when you're doing like 300 watts and they are easily producing those watts, that's basically just 25%, and the 75% of like of the total is basically heat. So basically they are radiators, and the heat has to go somewhere. And if it's in the middle of the summer, and it can really easily happen that they overheat and basically blew the whole race by just stupid mistake, by risking too much. I know what it is at stake when it comes to like those races and events, but I personally wouldn't risk it. And I personally see that, especially these days when we see like less this long attacks, I mean, long slow climbing, we've seen like more powerful surges of power towards the end, like, I don't know, Pogacar attacks, Roglic attacks, or someone attacks. You can't counter those attacks if you are like severely dehydrated and your VO2 max is not your oxygen uptake is not able to match the required workload. So basically, I would say that's probably not something you really want. For instance, this kind of dehydration would actually low sodium diet, for instance, would make sense for like British Hill Climb Championships. Because like it's a short event. Yeah, it's VO2 max event, but still it takes place in November, when it's cold. So cooling is not as important, and having a liter water in the body is basically can be beneficial. From performance standpoint, or for instance, if you're doing like a time trial uphill in Invernessike, for instance, summer, because in the duration of the time trial, which is like, I don't know, 40 minutes, you probably won't lose as much water that they're putting their performance. But when we're talking about 4 or 5 hours and the sweat rate of 2 liters per hour, I'm pretty sure that risking dehydration for the sake of being a few hundred grams lighter towards the end doesn't make sense. And we know increased body temperature increases the utilization of carbohydrates, so glycogen, which is something we don't really want. And there's like so many negative aspects of doing that, that I would definitely not ever recommend this practice.
Yeah, so it's a good point about sort of modern racing at that level. It does tend to be the key attacks always happen in that last kilometer or so, don't they? So, while you might be thinking, okay, it's a 40 minute climb, the key effort at the end is maybe a 5 minute VO2 max effort that determines whether you win the stage or you get dropped. So that's just something where, especially after that long in the saddle, being dehydrated is going to be negative for that, isn't it? Then I guess going back to the fact that it's in a stage race, you've got to think about your recovery for the next day as well. And then if you're finishing the stage more dehydrated, you've got to then rehydrate more for the next day to back to square one, really, haven't you?
Yeah, it's also like probably higher core temperature, and this also means probably more muscle damage. So it's probably like just multiplies the problems you kind of created that. So I wouldn't recommend doing that.
And then the final question we were going to cover today, and I guess it relates quite well to the endurance products on offer as well, really, is how would you adjust a hydration strategy for hotter or colder temperatures so that you're balancing your hydration but also getting enough energy and carbs? So especially if you're someone who likes to get more of their carbs for energy drink, I guess that's where using the 90 grams versus 45 grams version, for example, might come into play.
Yeah, it's a pretty good question. I think of quite a lot about this. And the thing is that, like, in the winter, what happens when you go usually for a ride and it's pretty chilly out there, one of the things usually happens is that you, like, kind of stop every, like, half an hour for a pee, and you need to, like, kind of produce a urine, and you haven't, like, drank a lot at all, but you still have to do that stop. And the reason is basically because it's cold, the body kind of constricts the blood vessels in the skin. So all the blood basically goes into the center of the body, and suddenly there is too much blood because the vessels in the skin have constricted. And as a result of that, body thinks, well, let's get rid of this water that's not needed. So you get rid of it by just going to the loo and on the side of the road. And to kind of counteract that, it can actually add more electrolytes into the drink and prevent this to happen, because basically hydration is regulated by the amount of sodium, pretty much in the concentration of sodium in the body. And if you kind of help the body to increase the amount of sodium, you can retain more water in the body, so the body will not get rid of it. So I think adding electrolytes in the winter is as important basically as in the summer. And I personally like don't really use electrolytes in the summer too much, but I always do use them in the winter for the sake of like not needing to stop every 30 minutes or so. And the other thing is it kind of feels nicer to have some electrolytes in the and some taste in the drink. And a bonus point, if it's minus and it's very cold, addition of electrolytes will make the water not to freeze. So if you're going like cross-country skiing, addition of electrolytes is a good idea from that point of view as well. But in terms of when we talk about the carbohydrates and the combination of electrolytes, race in long races, and I personally like don't really put a lot of emphasis on electrolytes. I just make sure that, like, because with endurance product line, we always make sure that you're getting the electrolytes you need, and kind of don't want to think about that. But in terms of, like, there are some products out there in the market, for instance, some gels and drinks that have absolutely zero electrolytes in them. And then you have to start thinking about how am I going to replace those electrolytes? Because as I said earlier, I think it makes sense to replace them to a certain degree, or as much as possible during exercise. So then you have to start thinking about it. And I think with endurance, and I'm just like, yeah, I'm promoting the products now, but I think we achieve this like the best way possible. So you replace what you lose to as high degree as possible, and the electrolytes are present in all the products, and you, whatever you ingest, you are getting those electrolytes in. But the other thing is, yeah, in the summer, I would probably use more fluid-based carbohydrates. So, 45 drink, and so, yeah, the normal energy unit drink, and the gels, and even have a bottle of water usually for the, like, to just splash the mouth, and get rid of the sweet taste. Whereas in the winter, I would consider using like 90, energy unit 90, just because the sweat rates are so much lower. So for the same amount of, for the less drinking, because yeah, I'm not sweating as much. I would need still to ingest carbohydrates. I would either use like bars or, but they can be really hard in the winter. So yeah, gels and 90 are highly concentrated drinks make more sense. It's kind of really personal, this. So that's why I'm kind of, yeah, talking all over the place now. But
so I guess it's just a case of treating the two things independently, really. It's like,
yeah,
are my carbohydrate needs for this session what are my hydration needs for
exactly
it? Whether you do it in the winter or the summer, the same session, you're probably going to have similar carbohydrate needs, but your fluids could be drastically different. So you're altering where you're getting your carbs from to help take care of that hydration side of things as well.
Yeah, exactly. So there are people like that really like to have carbohydrates in the form of drinks. So you will see many athletes out there. They would rely more on drinks than on gels. I'm the opposite. I always rely on gels because I find them easier to kind of calculate the amounts that way, and just have the drink just water. So it's completely separate hydration to nutrition. But that's just me, and everyone is different, and you can do whatever you want. But thinking about both independently, or like what's gonna happen, like in the summer, well, hydration and carbohydrate intake have to be high, whereas in the winter, hydration is not as important. Carbohydrate intake remains to be important. So, this is something to keep in mind, perhaps.
Cool. I think we've only said those three questions, but I think that covered quite a broad range of the questions we did have in. So if we kind of wrap that up for today, any comments, questions, please put them down in the comments below. And I think next time we've got a guest coming on, haven't we?
Hopefully she will come.
Fingers crossed.
I'll probably announce it on my Instagram and or on the Endurance Instagram, and then we'll also ask for questions for her, so that we can do a sort of Q&A at the end of the session as well.
Brilliant. Great speech, Tim, and we'll sign off for now, and we'll speak soon.
Yeah, thanks, and see you soon.
No, all right.